I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Is there anyone listening who hasn't been touched by addiction? Family member, neighbor, coworker, or yourself? Well, 12-step programs such as Alcoholics Anonymous have become a mainstay for treatment. However, there's a movement now challenging the value of anonymity and introducing self-disclosure. People are coming out and sharing their stories publicly in hopes this will stop stigma and to support others. On today's show, we'll be discussing addiction and recovery with Jill Bauer, whose own story of addiction has led her to find the Rooms Project, Roland Lamb, director of the Mayor's Office of Addiction Services, and Denise Mariano, a parent whose direct experience with addiction has motivated her to become involved as a parent advocate. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear your stories, whether you choose to be anonymous or not. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Roland Lamb.
Hello.
Hey, Roland. full disclosure here, Roland and I first met, that's 40 years ago, I'll bet,
close to it, 1974.
Yeah, I was director of two outpatient drug programs in West Philly, and Roland was a young buck who I was supervising and training. So Roland, these days we're hearing more and more about addiction through personal stories. Even some of the people running for president have talked about members of their own family. Jeb Bush tells a poignant story of visiting his daughter in prison.
Right.
Do you think all of this self-disclosure translates into more programming, more funding, even more compassion for substance abusers?
Well, Dan, I hope so. It's translated so far in the state making recommendations for increased funding for overdose, you know, prevention and overdose rescue. We have a new Good Samaritan law that's out now that allows people to report, you know, who are actively using, report when someone overdoses and not be, you know, subject to conviction. And I'm hoping that there's a larger issue, and that is that we're moving towards not just funding an episode of care, but looking to fund the entire continuum of care.
What's the prognosis, Ron?
It's mixed. It's mixed. When you consider the fact that we have a state that won't pass a budget, in spite of the fact that we have a quote-unquote epidemic of the non-medical use of prescribed opiates and then heroin. On top of that, it makes you wonder where the priorities are. I still feel that stigma is driving a lot of the behavior that we're seeing.
Even though the vast majority of people in the legislature have been touched by addiction.
That is true. And we've heard stories after stories, especially in both rural and suburban Pennsylvania, of legislators who have family members and have close acquaintances and neighbors who have suffered from the disease of addiction. In fact, you know, one of the things is trying to get more services in those areas to be able to manage some of the ongoing issues that are happening there.
Are you able to do that?
I wish we could. I think that, you know, right now everything is at a standstill. We're looking to, you know, get more programs in place. We have an agenda, especially in Philadelphia, to build more community-based services because in reality, recovery doesn't occur in a program. It occurs in a community.
Like I mentioned earlier in the introduction, you've been in the business for many years now. What changes have you seen with regard to stigma specifically, if any?
The biggest change that I've seen has been the transformation over the last 10 years here in Philadelphia. With Dr. Evans at the helm, Philadelphia has moved from an acute care provider-focused system to a more recovery orientation. And the involvement of people who are in recovery and people of lived experience in that transformation has been phenomenal.
Define recovery, Roland, because part of the program here is about 12-step and other options for 12-step. So what do you mean by recovery? What does that programming look like?
It looks like, first of all, it's a celebration of the person who comes into treatment. It's actually a opportunity for us to begin to welcome folks in to treat a disease. It's not about, you know, ostracizing them or blaming them for the disease. It's also about, you know, developing person-first relationships. Recovery is about becoming self-actualized. It's empowering. It's about hope. It's about the fact that people do recover, and they do recover in phenomenal ways with respects to themselves, their families, and their communities.
I want to be careful here. You know, we're talking about alternatives to 12-step programs. We're talking about challenging anonymity. But I want to be careful because 12-step programs have saved millions and millions of lives, including people in my own family. Mm-hmm. So we're not saying anything negative about 12-step programs. They're a godsend for millions. Mm-hmm. But we are exploring alternatives. So when you talk about recovery, are you talking about a 12-step model or others, some in addition?
I'm talking about a transform model that includes 12-step. If we think of recovery as the umbrella, that people begin to become self-actualizing and become empowered, then 12-step is one door that people come through. Their faith-based, you know, is another door that people come through. Treatment programs, you know, where you get professional treatment is another door that people come through. You have also community-based programs that people come through. We have a huge amount of, I have a huge amount of respect for the community-based programs that are bringing people in and not even engaging them in a professional way.
What's that look like?
It looks like, you know, programs that are in the community for HIV/AIDS, homelessness, that are also, because, you know, addiction is so intertwined with those two things, they now are bringing folks in, and not with the caveat that you have to be in a treatment program. The idea is that you're safe, that you're out of the cold. And then as we continue to engage that person in those programs, then maybe treatment becomes an option. Maybe the family, you know, gets involved and treatment becomes an option for them as well.
Hmm. Years ago, we had a woman on the show who was living on the streets and out, going between shelters in the street. It was many years ago when having HIV, you know, death sentence.
Yes.
Almost. And she was a recovering heroin addict. Mm. And I said to her, you know, how do you do this? With all these problems, she said, I've only got one problem. She said, my only problem is staying clean and sober one day at a time. Because if that goes downhill, everything else falls apart.
Yeah.
And if I stay clean and sober, everything's possible.
Right.
And, you know, I thought that was a very, very powerful statement.
Mm-hmm.
There's an article that I read several years earlier. It was published in Time magazine. It suggested that the majority of people who recover from addiction do so without 12-step programs. It's a pretty provocative statement. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts?
It's kind of hard to figure, but that number, I mean, or that statement has been echoed in a number of different places, that people are recovering. There's an interesting study that was done on women who were in their addiction, and they followed women, both African-American and white women, out of their addiction. And after 3 years after they had left the program, they found that in many cases that the white women had stayed involved with AA and NA. But, you know, interesting. Do you have any idea what you think the black women, you know, went to?
Yeah, I'm surprised they didn't stay. Go on.
No, they found them in church.
Church, of course.
Yeah, and they became very much engaged there. And so, you know, I happen to believe that 12-step movements, you know, are a part of the recovery journey. And for some, they become the recovery journey. And for others, they become how you get to that journey.
Well, we can't just say 12-step programs because, you know, they might follow the same steps and traditions, but I know from my patients' experiences and mine when I was in Al-Anon, every room is very different.
That's right.
They have their own personality, their own set of expectations. Some rooms, they frown on other therapies, even antidepressants, and some rooms don't.
Right.
So you can't even generalize about 12-step programs.
No, it's sort of like saying that, you know, all black people, you know, are the same. We're not. And I think that part of the issue is that when you talk about the 12-step movement, you have an interpretation of the 12 steps, the 12 traditions. And, you know, one of the things that goes on in the 12 traditions is that each group, each 12-step meeting is actually supposed to be different. It's supposed to be of its own, you know, making, and it's supposed to have a cultural perspective to it. So I think that in large part, you know, you're seeing, you know, for instance, there is an undercurrent within the 12-step movement about medication-assisted treatment. You mentioned it earlier in terms of the use of psychotropics. And for a long time, there was even a taboo that even, you know, psychotropic mental health medication was, you know, a no-no. And soon, you know, and over time, that's become less so. But now we have a problem in terms of medication-assisted treatment for opiate dependence and the idea of using methadone or buprenorphine or Suboxone, as some people don't understand, or Vivitrol is frowned upon. And the reality is that if I were to say to you that we were both diabetics, I'm a type 2 diabetic, you're a type 2 diabetic, and you can live your life without medication and maintain your diet and exercise, but I need to have medication and I need to have, you know, more support around my dieting and exercise, what makes my recovery from my diabetes any less worthwhile than your recovery from diabetes? And I think that becomes a real hallmark, and I think that part of the issue is that you have some meetings that are more accepting of that, and you have other meetings that are less accepting of that.
If you're just tuning in, you've been listening to Roland Lamb, who's with the mayor's office of addiction services. We're talking about addiction. We're talking about 12-step programs. It's options and the recovery movement. Our number is 888-477-9499. Let's see if we can squeeze a phone call in before we go to break. We've got Dill on the line.
Hi, Dan. I'm on?
Yes.
Yeah, hi. I have a lot of experience in helping people in recovery, and I've read the 12 steps, 12 traditions, and the reason for the anonymity isn't so much about somebody's an addict or an alcoholic's personal embarrassment or shame or their feelings. It's really a lot to do with about, you know, the group. Like if we have Robert Downey Jr. In front of it, and in fact, it says if you read the book at the level of press, radio, and television.
Right.
So if you want to go through your neighborhood and tell everybody about your recovery, that's great. That's your choice. But as far as the 12-step program, there's many programs. There's church, there's counseling, there's Vitrol, there's, you know. But as far as the 12-step program, the anonymity is vital to the success, the outstanding success of the program. And the reasons are not at all about your personal feelings or this. You know, it has a lot to do with, you know, the group is more interested in attraction than promotion.
Right.
And it's, and it's how it works. And I could go into depth about it. You really should read the 12 traditions and certainly the one about the anonymity and the reasons for it. And it's really not at all about how a person feels or their shame or their this. It's about keeping the group functional.
Yeah, or how they behave outside of the group. Dill, I really appreciate your call and your perspective. Roland, we talked before the show about how this anonymity thing has been misinterpreted,
yes,
both inside and outside of 12 steps. Say more.
Well, I think that when you take a look as Dill said, the 12 steps and the 12 traditions, it's more of an organizational, you know, component. But we've had over time misinterpretation on the part of a number of people about the fact that you can't share. And you can't, you know, reach out to other folks. And that's not true of all people who are in an AA or AA, but the reality is that for many, that becomes a very, you know, restricting, you know, problem. And I think that what we really need to do is begin to think in terms of, you know, the amount of harm that it does when someone says that I can't share. And, you know, to them and to people around them who actually, you know, could benefit from them sharing.
Yeah. Let's take a short break, and then when we come back, we're going to be joined, in addition to Roland Lamb, who's with the Mayor's Office of Addiction Services, we're going to be joined by Jill Bauer. She's a photographer, photojournalist, and a founder of the Rooms Project that we'll hear a lot more about. It's just fascinating. We're also going to be joined on the phone by Denise Mariano. She's a parent advocate with quite a story of her own to share. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. We'd love to hear from you, your experience inside and outside of 12-step programs, and your feelings about anonymity, yours and others. Our number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
This is Dr. Ashiwira Rutna from the Wistar Institute, a proud supporter of WHYY. As a Wistar scientist, I'm working hard to help find a cure for melanoma, the deadliest form of skin cancer. My research focuses on how changes in our skin as we age drives the spread of melanoma and makes these tumors resistant to drugs. To find out the importance of wearing sunscreen and more about our science, details are at wistar.org. My name is Ashi, and I am Wistar Science.
Supporting WHYY, Yampolsky Law PC, a law firm based in Tree Rose, Pennsylvania, focused on transforming conflict through mindful practices of collaborative law, mediation, family law, and labor and employment law. More information at conflicttransformed.com.
Supporting WHYY, the Association of American University Presses celebrates University Press Week and the work of mission-driven scholarly publishers. AAUP, because great minds don't think alike. UniversityPressWeek.org, hashtag read up.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about addictions, alternative to 12-step programs, and the role of anonymity, both positive and negative. We've been talking with Roland Lamb, director of the Mayor's Office of Addiction Service. Now we're going to be joined by Denise Mariano, a parent advocate, and Jill Bauer, a photographer. And again, our number is 888-477-9499. Denise, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great conversation going.
Well, thanks. 2.5 years ago, you were trying to find options for your teenage son who was addicted. You were then confronted with a system that you described as failing those with addictions. How so?
Well, you know, so many of us, our parents, are blindsided by this. Unfortunately, what we learn in school is, you know, not truly what we see when, you know, we're blindsided with this disease when our children are struggling. So the first thing we do is try to reach out to our insurance companies, and we were denied treatment for close to 2 years. We knocked down every door. Every door was closed. And so you become an advocate naturally and truly just, you know, desperately tried to gain some help for your child. That's where the system did fail us and continues to fail us. I see a lot of improvement and sometimes changing, but it's a disgrace. And with any other medical disease, this wouldn't be the case.
How would you change it?
How would I change it? I would treat it like any other medical disease, with individualized care and with love and compassion. You know, it's a medical disease, so why we're treating it any differently. Of course, I think everybody on this line can agree that, you know, the stigma of it all is the reason why it's treated this way.
Amen.
And that's kind of been why I'm hitting the pavement, sharing our story, how to lend a face to addiction and really lend a face to recovery. So in reducing that stigma, you know, maybe others that are suffering today can get the treatment that they need.
So you became a parent advocate. And
I did.
Yeah. Why? And what does all that mean?
I don't think I ever defined that I was a parent advocate. It was really just a natural process. For a couple years when my son was struggling, I just, because we were not opted any care, I just, you know, hit the pavement, learning everything that I possibly could and what other options I might have. And then I began sharing that, actually, anonymously for some time, thinking that there might be another 1,000 or 1,000,000 parents in the same situation as myself. And then I was doing it anonymously, just out of respect for my son. And after I saw a movie, The Anonymous People, it was a real pivotal moment for me, and it was empowering. And I thought, well, maybe I could, you know, help make some changes happen or help that family and plant some seeds and reduce some stigma. So I didn't decide to become an advocate. It just was par for the course when you're on this journey kind of thing.
You know, I've heard that story with parents, mothers of autistic children, millions and millions and millions of times. And because of parent advocacy, you see all the funding it's getting. You know, I mean, we're far from cures, but it's getting a ton of funding. It's getting a lot of attention, and it's getting a lot of respect. And that wouldn't have happened were it not for, you know, parent advocates. So you were at the White House.
I was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, I guess I was nominated somewhere, you know, for my advocacy work. But really, in the end, it truly wasn't about me. It was just a wonderful thing to have, you know, the family voice there, because we can make a difference. We live this. So when I speak of tides changing, it wasn't that Denise was at the White House, but that an advocate was chosen by the White House that represented the family voice. And, you know, I couldn't say that. I couldn't even think that would be a possibility only 2 years ago. And that's another reason why I do what I do, because you see the tides changing. You see that we're making a difference. It's not about getting loud. It's just getting our stories out there and, you know, being a source of hope for other families.
It's not about being loud. It's about getting our stories out there. Let's, you know, Jill Bauer, let's bring you in. You've been very patient for the first part of the show. I've been watching you have all of these emotions and reactions, especially to Roland Lamb. So tell us about the Rooms Project.
Sure. Well, thank you for having me here, first of all. The Rooms Project is a photo and audio story series that I started in March of 2014, after I celebrated a year of recovery. So, essentially, I have traveled to about 20 different states, and I record stories of recovery from people that are in the recovery community. And I photograph them in their own environment, and people can kind of get like a face and a voice for somebody that's in recovery.
So, why?
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 So, I actually entered recovery because a friend of mine, a Facebook friend of mine, who I didn't know very well, was open about being in recovery, and I was struggling. And this was somebody that looked like me. They dressed like me. We had the same interests, about the same age. And when I was ready, after many, many years of active addiction and alcohol abuse, I reached out to this person on Facebook, and because I connected with them, and they kind of set me on my path. from there.
So it was being open, someone else being open.
Yeah.
You talk about recovery, 12-step, more?
So this project actually started, so my own personal journey involves 12-step program. But so when I started this project, I actually was very naive. And I thought that 12-step programs were the only ways that people could get clean and sober. And what I learned through traveling to all these different states as I started stumbling on all of these people who had received, you know, medication-assisted treatment, for example, who had gone to other peer-based recovery programs like Celebrate Recovery, for example. And so the project has kind of expanded to include all different types of recovery. I have stuck to, you know, all of the stories are told in like a 12-step narrative that you would often hear at a 12-step meeting. So regardless of, you know, what pathway each of the people on the site have, you know, chosen, their story is at least still captured to focus on, you know, what their life was like, what happened, and what their life is like now.
You know, when I heard about the project, Jill, I wondered, you know, I think it's the 12th step. Having had, I think it was spiritual awakening, we promised to carry this message. Something like that.
Yeah.
So are you carrying this message? I mean, is this part of your 12-step work?
I mean, it's definitely not part of my 12-step program. The two are very, very separate. So I've had to do that, you know, for my own sanity, I think. I have my 12-step program. And then
that's right. I've had to do a radio show for my sanity. So, you know, we all do what we need to do.
Yeah.
Let's go to the phones. We've got a lot of callers who want to join the conversation. We'll start with Maria. Hi, Maria.
Hi. My question is, thank you so much for having this program today. I had a son who is recently struggling with addiction and was is at a safe place that has people in a program. It was daunting to try to find the right place for him. How do you sit through all of these wonderful suggestions to make sure that you're choosing the program that will help the person see the addiction and get on the road to recovery? And also, in helping the family as well. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And I'm going to start with you, Roland Lamb, about what are the answers? How do you find programs? And what's around for families in addition to Al-Anon?
There are a lot of programs that advertise that they do a great deal of family work and whatnot, but I think that families are going to have to do some legwork themselves. They're going to have to find out, you know, how inclusive the program is of family. They're going to have to find out how, you know, what the program's agenda is, how the program looks at, serving the person. It has to go beyond an episode of care. There has to be the inclusion of whatever supports that are around that person.
You know, this bothers me, what you're saying, and I accept it as true, but, you know, it's like somebody with depression, you know, and they have to research and make all these calls. For God's sakes, they have depression. They can't do this. And somebody with an addiction or a family member, I mean, I've been in that boat, and I know resources, but I was frantic at the time. And you know, I mean, I know the system. So
what really is frustrating, and I think for everyone, is the fact that because of stigma, we've so long, you know, pushed aside, you know, the importance of treatment and treatment programs. So now that we only know the programs that advertise, for instance, and there are not that many that advertise, you know, in this area.
And many of them are for profit.
Right.
And which could be good news or bad news, you know.
And that's why I'm saying that to a certain degree, for all parents, not just for parents who know that their kids are involved, but for all parents, there has to be a willingness to begin to explore what's out there.
Denise, how did you find your way?
You know, a lot of it was research. And just like Roland said, there's so much out there that we don't know about. And until we research that, and then if we can share it, which so many of us do today, there's so many paths to help your child to recovery. There is no one-size-fits-all, and we truly have to respect all paths. My advice is always given, you know, to tough love and to kick them out. And, you know, my son was 19. It wasn't an option for me. So, you know, I hit the pavement looking for other options where I found craft and motivational interviewing. And I believed as a family we could make a difference. So, unfortunately, you have to do that legwork. But there's a ton of resources that weren't there 3 years ago at the Partnership for Drug-Free Kids. They have tons of resources on all different paths to recovery. And there truly is no one-size-fits-all, but it shouldn't be this cookie-cutter blanket statement, and this is what you have to do, because each family is unique, each child is unique, and we bring a different dynamic. And whatever path, really, truly, the best path is the path that works for you.
I'm curious about, Jill, how did you find your way?
Well, this is interesting. My parents, over the years, had tried many miniature interventions, and none of them worked, and I needed, you know, that willingness along the way. And so I think, for me, I had many, many bottoms, but mine was an emotional bottom that I needed to have on my own. And one thing that kept me drinking and using for so long was that I told myself that I was young and that it was a phase, which is why I do think it's so important for, you know, young people to have access to faces and voices of young people in recovery as well, to know that they do have a disease or they might have a disease.
It's a powerful statement you just made, you know, that part of our responsibility, maybe, I'm not so sure that's the right word for those of us who have been treated or family members who have been treated, mm-hmm. to reach out to, you know, to make our voices public, mm-hmm. so others won't be ashamed or won't be frightened. Mm-hmm. Roland, one question before we take a break. You know, we've been talking about how difficult it is to find resources. Isn't this part of your job?
Yeah,
to make it clear for people.
Yeah, and we do have a number of different mechanisms to get people information, but it has to also be about, you know, the circumstances that people are coming out of. We have over 57 licensed drug and alcohol treatment providers operating 117 facilities across the city of Philadelphia. And that's just in terms of the public side of it, the side that I oversee. But however, not all programs work for all people. And if we understand that addiction is a chronically relapsing disease and that people, you know, are going to struggle in their addiction, we got to find programs that have seven characteristics, at least for me, and these are my characteristics. One, they celebrate the people that they serve. You know, two, that they engage in building relationships, not only with the person, but with their resources, their families, and their community. Three, they, you know, esteem is not a one-sided thing. That with the fact that I come to your program is esteem building. Your program doesn't only build esteem in me. My coming builds esteem in the program. You know, four, we're looking at the fact that we're part of a community of recovery, that we share that community with each other, and the program is invested in me beyond the episode.
How do we find all those things out? You know, I've got a daughter, a son who's addicted, or I'm addicted. How do I find all these things out?
Well, ideally, we get you in the door, whether it's through a licensed program or whether it's through a community-based program.
So I can call you?
Yes, you can.
Or your office.
In fact, I'll give you two numbers I would like for you to call, if you wouldn't mind.
Go on.
Okay, one is 215-546-1200. That's the called Behavioral Health Special Initiative, and that's the funding for the uninsured and underinsured in Philadelphia.
And we're going to get them on our webpage.
Okay, and then the next number is 1-888 545-2600. And that's the number to CBH's member services. Community Behavioral Health. And that's their member services. And they are for the people who have Medicaid. And if I can make sure that you can call either one of those two numbers.
We're going to get those numbers on our webpage, and they'll be available for our listeners. We do have to take a short break, and we've got lots and lots of callers who want to join the conversation. No real surprise there. There's lots and lots of people who are touched by this. Well, we've been talking about addiction, stigma, anonymity, and alternatives to 12-step programs with Roland Lamb, director of the Mayor's Office of Addiction Service. Jill Bauer is a photographer, founder of the Rooms Project, and we're going to hear more about that. Denise Mariano is a parent advocate who is working hard to change the world, and we wish her all the success in the world. All three are going to be back after a short break. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation helps make nonprofits stronger, offering workshops and services designed to increase effectiveness and build the capacity of organizations throughout southeastern Pennsylvania. The Philadelphia Foundation can help you support the organizations you care about today and forever while you receive tax deductions. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or online at philafound.org.
Karen Treatment Center supports WHYY. Addiction can test a family's strength. When someone you love is struggling with addiction, you struggle too. Karen can help restore peace in your home. For more than 60 years, Karen has worked in the field of addiction treatment and behavioral health care, impacting the lives of thousands of patients and their families. Karen will help you take the next step. A confidential and no-obligation assessment is available at 855-894-4325 or at caron.org.
We're back on Voices in the Family with Roland Lamb from the Mayor's Office, Jill Bauer, a recovering photojournalist who started the Rooms Project, Denise Mariano, a parent advocate. Jill.
Yeah.
I felt a little uncomfortable just now when I talked about someone, a recovering photojournalist. Tell me your feelings about anonymity.
Mm-hmm.
And have they changed, and what's the value of it, and where does it help, where does it hurt?
Sure. I mean, I think that you can talk about your own recovery without disclosing what organization you're a part of, and therefore you're avoiding breaking any of the traditions of the 12-step organization that you might be a part of. And so I was a pretty public drunk. And so when I got sober, realistically, you know, I had kind of gone away and gotten better. And I think it was pretty obvious to a lot of people that I had entered recovery at that point. And so I feel like, you know, to me, I'm not even sure that I had anonymity in the first place with a lot of people.
Why are you public with this?
Because I think that the people that I'm, you know, meeting through this project and the stories that I'm sharing could be that story that was shared for me, you know, on Facebook. And I think it could, you know, spread the hope for people and give somebody, someone else to identify with.
I'm sitting here looking at a real live human across from me who, you know, you've got your story and we know just the surface of who you are.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know how you are physically, emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
If I asked you how your life was today, what would you say?
A lot better. A lot better. And a lot more stable. You know, on the surface, I think people that knew me professionally did not know that this was a problem for me. And so I was definitely one of those people who could maintain not one, but three jobs. you know, a pretty good job working in a large corporation. I was teaching college classes on the side, and I had started a photography company before entering recovery. And so a lot of my issues, my mental well-being was not good when I was drinking and using, but I was able to kind of move around and make it appear as though my life was great on the outside.
Before we go to the phones, Denise, I want to ask you quickly. I mean, clearly you came out and decided not to stay anonymous. I assume you needed your son's permission or no?
So my son, who's now in recovery for 2.5 years, yeah, I do ask his permission, but I never really self-disclose my son's story. Mm. I really, when I'm out there, I'm talking about the family story and with the hope that maybe, you know, one person might listen to my self-disclosure. You know, we're planting seeds out there. And so, again, I don't talk about his story, but our journey as a family and the hurdles that we had to jump and, you know, what has become of those hurdles that we jumped. But he's a great resource to check back into.
Mm.
And there's often times where I say, you know, what could I have done differently or, you know, and so forth. So he's a great inspiration and a great knowledge base for me to talk to now, too, as I coach other families to help their children.
That's great. Let's go to the phones. We've got Pam on the line. Hi, Pam.
Hi, Dr. Dan.
How are you? What can we do for you?
I just wanted to mention that another path to recovery is the online community.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, you said that, and both of my guests nodded their heads at the same time. Yeah, I thought we were in an Orthodox Jewish prayer service here. So go on, Pam.
Well, I just found that the 12-step program wasn't a good fit for me. I don't really believe in a higher power. And after coming out of meetings, I just felt so horrible about myself. So I found some sober blogs where people shared their recovery, and especially one sober blog where she talked about that people who have addiction issues, they're not broken. And they just have this, I guess, voice in their head that tells them to drink. And she gives the voice a name called Wolfie. And every time, so I've been sober for over 2 years now, and, you know, sometimes there's still a voice that says, oh, a glass of wine would be great. And I know that that's not me talking, that's Wolfie talking, so I can shut it down.
That's great. You know, we talk about, I teach self-compassion, and you know, everybody's got that critical voice, and it's important to know when it's talking, to be able to name it, and to change your relationship with it. You know, you don't want your critical voice in the driver's seat. That's going to mess everything up. That's just a great story. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
So let's start with you, Jill. What was that big head nod about with the online?
I mean, a couple of things. For one of the women that I had met on one of the road trips that I had taken uses Twitter solely to sustain her recovery. And through Twitter, she's able to meet tons of different people who are all living in recovery. Some are anonymous, some are not anonymous. And so I think that's a good resource for people, just as like an extra path that people can use. And also, I think, you know, with social media, I think that a lot of people, because of social media, are not anonymous because they're posting on social media a lot of information about themselves. And I think that's why, you know, part of the reason why we're seeing a movement here and people coming forward, because they're already disclosing their stories on social media. They're a little bit more comfortable, especially younger people that grew up, you know, on Facebook and Twitter and whatever other sites they're using now. But yeah.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Carrot on the line.
Hello?
Hi, Carrot.
Hi. I had a question, Dr. Dan, kind of similar to the last person who mentioned having an issue with a higher power. What would you say to someone who either is an atheist or, in my experience, who has, like, kind of significant trauma surrounding religion, who feels like these 12-step programs are kind of inaccessible due to their foundational level of, like, you, it doesn't matter what higher power, but you must have one, which has been my experience in going to any meetings, whether it's, like, as a visitor or at Al-Anon or even at Overeaters Anonymous, there's always this level of you have to believe in a higher power. You can't really do this on your own. And I can take my answer off.
Yeah, and you know, one of the steps refers to a defect of character, which is certainly not good for someone who's experienced trauma of any type. You know, if you've experienced trauma, and I want to hear you weigh in on this. I mean, many people with substance abusers have experienced significant trauma. But if trauma around religion and faith is what you're carrying with you, I wouldn't recommend a 12-step program. I mean, my God, look at what we're hearing here about all the alternatives. Roland, I want your reaction, because I saw Jill wasn't thrilled with
I just think that number one, ultimately, the power comes out of the community, whether we're talking about it's a religious community or our religious orientation. But the idea of being able to communicate with other people who have, you know, a lived experience and who can share with each other, I think is ultimately important. I think the other thing is that addiction doesn't happen in a vacuum, that we are human beings and it becomes a part of the human condition. And with it comes trauma, with it comes, you know, some very negative experiences. And also we carry around a great deal of what is considered to be blame. That we don't forgive ourselves for. And I think that there has to be a mechanism for us to be able to have a discussion about that and what it means to be who we are. And it doesn't necessarily mean that we have to have a quote-unquote higher power. It means that how are we empowered to do that? And I think that that's where we have to go ultimately. And I would suggest that there are, you know, places that we can go to wrestle with, you know, the issues of trauma, wrestle with the issues of abuse, wrestle with the issues of our addiction, and not necessarily have to be connected to a quote-unquote higher power. You know, spiritual does not necessarily mean religious.
Yeah, you're not kidding. Joe?
And, I mean, with that, I would agree. And spiritual does not mean religious. And so I think a lot of people, such as myself, who did choose, you know, a 12-step path, or not even choose it, just wound up there probably, you know, I used a large group of people, you know, and that was kind of a power that was greater than myself. Here was a group of people that, you know, when they came together, they could stay in recovery together. And on my own, that was not something that I could do. And so you don't have to be a religious person to participate or become a member of a 12-step organization.
You do have to be open to translating it to make it fit
right.
Yourself.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know,
yeah.
And, you know, higher power, you're mm-hmm. right. To many people, you can translate that to be whatever you need it to right. be. I mean, mm-hmm. in my case, mm-hmm. it was about having faith, literally faith, mm-hmm. in my own resilience. Mm-hmm. You know, so, but, you know, if you come in there with trauma around this, mm-hmm. you're less likely, mm-hmm. less mm-hmm. likely to be open. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Daniel on the line. Hey, Daniel.
Yes, hello, Tom. First off, I'd like to thank you for your years of broadcast. I've been listening to you on the radio for as long as I can remember, so thank you for that.
Thank you.
The other thing I wanted to mention, I am personally a recovering cocaine addict, and I've been clean for a number of years now, and I must say I did it without the support of a 12-step program or a church group. I found my path to sobriety through my friends and family and loved ones that I am least anonymous with. And I approached them and I said, you know, I'm a cocaine addict. I need to stay away from it. And anyone that I knew would not respect that decision, I was forced to cut from my life. And the people that are still in my life are the people that I knew loved me enough to respect my decision. And I know some of my friends still use cocaine, but they respect me enough to not use it anywhere near me, to not let me see it, to not let me know about it, out of respect for my decision to stay sober. And I you know, think that relying on your friends and family for me was crucial, but none of that would have been any help whatsoever had I not come to the decision for myself that I want to be sober for me.
Daniel, I think that's a really important message, and we're running low on time, so I really want to thank you for what you've said and for what you're doing. Sounds wonderful. And
well, thank you.
The one thing that comes out of this in 12 steps, out of 12 steps, anonymity or not, is devotion.
Mm-hmm.
If you are devoted, I mean devoted, to your own welfare, devoted to your own recovery,
mm-hmm.
your prognosis is much better. And then you can get help either in structured programs or outside of structured programs, mm-hmm. like Twitter. But without that devotion, things just don't work. And that's the case with everything, with marriages too, and with physical health. Well, we are out of time. I really want to thank all three of you for what you're doing and for your great contributions. Roland Lamb, thanks for coming out.
Thank you for the invitation.
And Jill Bauer, thank you. Thanks for the work you do.
Thank you.
And Denise Mariano, same to you too. You're doing wonderful work.
Thank you.
And thanks for joining us on this show. And there's a link on our website to a lot of these resources. Hey, a program note. While November 23rd is the end of our weekly show, I'm not going anywhere. You'll still hear my Monday chats with Mike and Scott. We're already busy at work for our bi-monthly specials, and which will give you a chance to be part of it on the community. And our first one's going to be in January. So follow us. We're at Twitter at Voices in the Fam. I'll be making weekly posts in there, so stay in touch. And also, check out my webpage. It's dynamic and it's changing. DrDanGottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Adam Staniszewski. Elizabeth Perez-Lunar is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Trin Thatch is our intern. Larry Roebling produces this show. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Please enjoy your week, my friends.